One of the greatest reference works in theology I have on my shelf and use all the time is an oldie but goodie called Fundamentals of Catholic Dogma by Ludwig Ott. It reads a bit more like a telephone book than a gripping novel, and I know that by using the term telephone book, I just dated myself. So kiddos, if you don't know what a telephone book is, ask your mama after Mass, and she might be able to tell you. But this book goes through the teachings of the Church and provides where they come from in Scripture, philosophy, and tradition. It's a good user manual for basic theology. Unfortunately, many people who study theology nowadays don't have this clear, concise, basic knowledge. Theology students today want to do advanced calculus before they even learn their multiplication tables. And the fact that the internet has given every lunatic a voice means that many Catholics are very confused about even the most fundamental truths of our faith. Where we see the most confusion regards the fact that not every teaching of the Church has the same weight, nor does every teaching require the same level of assent or obedience. Some of our Protestant friends paint this caricature of authority and obedience in the Church. For many of them, the Pope is an absolute monarch whose every whim is to be blindly obeyed without question under pain of eternity in hell. The sad thing is that there are actually Catholics who think the same thing, or at least veer perilously close to it. One of my favorite novels is Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited. In it, the Canadian business tycoon Rex Mottram feels that he has to become a Catholic to marry the socialite Julia Flight, and so he goes to Father Mowbray for instruction. And Father Mowbray recounts what happened. He said, "Yesterday I asked him whether our Lord had more than one nature. He said, 'Just as many as you say, Father.'" Okay. Suppose that the Pope says it's going to rain tomorrow. Does that mean it will rain? "Oh, yes, Father." But supposing it doesn't rain, what then? Well, I guess it would be spiritually raining, only we were too sinful to see it. Father Mowbray tells the mother of the bride-to-be, "He doesn't correspond to any degree of paganism known to the missionaries. I shall be dead long before Rex is a Catholic." In reality, though, we have rather a lot of Rex Mottrams in the Church. And the reason is that the very clear categorization of the teachings of the faith and the assent required of them that is present in something like Ludwig Ott's textbook is now no longer known or appreciated. True authority has been replaced by sheer will to power, in which truth doesn't seem to have a lot to do with it. In many places, the Pope has been reduced to a mere granter of executive orders that can undo those of his predecessor. And people have made the Church into a series of conflicting political parties that are all jockeying for power to impose their opinion on the Church and call anyone who disagrees with that opinion a disloyal dissenter who isn't really a Catholic. So, is there a way out of this? Yes. By realizing what teachings have what weight and what assent Catholics are expected to have. The first category, or rung, if you want to use a ladder analogy, of things to be believed are de fide divina, on divine faith, because they are divinely revealed, okay, such as the Trinity or the resurrection. The second rung comprises things to be believed de fide catholica, on Catholic faith, things which proceed from divine revelation, which have been the subject of infallible doctrinal definitions of the Church, such as papal infallibility or the Assumption. You know, the Trinity and the resurrection have never been defined. Well, because they're so obvious. I mean, if you don't believe Jesus is risen from the dead, why on earth are you here, right? You don't need to define what's obvious to be a Christian. Papal infallibility and the Assumption, however, have been defined after a process of discernment by the Church that those doctrines belong to the original deposit of faith handed on by Christ to his apostles. Most theologians teach that a truth of Catholic and not divine faith that is not definitively taught may require theological assent, but nobody is required to believe it is divinely revealed before it is actually defined. Example, St. Thomas Aquinas, whose feast we celebrated last week, did not believe in the Immaculate Conception, but it had not been defined de fide catholica yet, and so he wasn't a bad Catholic. Now, if you or I deliberately deny this Catholic truth, then we are guilty of the sin of heresy. On the third rung are consequences or presuppositions of the teaching of Revelation. These truths are not immediately revealed, but are so intrinsically connected with the truths of Revelation that their denial would undermine those truths. They are called Catholic truths to distinguish them from the divine truths above. And these include theological conclusions, dogmatic facts, truths of reason. The fact that St. Peter was the first bishop of Rome and has universal jurisdiction over the whole church, that's such a truth. Philosophical concepts of person, substance, transubstantiation, those are also Catholic truths. They're not divine revelation itself, but they flow from it, and as such require a lower level of assent, not because they're somehow less worthy of belief, but because they do not as immediately come from God. Finally, the fourth rung are theological opinions, which are free views on aspects of faith and morals. Sometimes the teaching authority of the Church defines one opinion over another, but until then, there is freedom in this area. Four rungs, but what levels of assent do we as Catholics owe to them? First, fides divina. Divine faith is owed to doctrines de fide divina. We believe them because God himself reveals them. Second, fides catholica, Catholic faith, is owed to those doctrines de fide catholica. We believe them because they have been defined by a solemn judgment of the Pope or an ecumenical council as a truth contained in divine revelation. Third, Catholic truths are accepted solely on the authority of the Church and are infallibly certain as dogmas proper. Okay, so now once you get past the first three sets of levels of assent to the first three levels of dogma into our fourth rung, that's where we get into a very different world. That is the space where theology, which seeks to explain the faith, speculates about what is in dogma. their teachings, which are to be taken on fides ecclesiastica, entirely on faith in the church. Then sententia fide proxima, teachings proximate to faith, which are generally regarded by theologians as true, but not defined. After that, sententia certa, conclusions drawn from the last category. Then sententia communis, common teaching, generally accepted by theologians. Finally, sententia probabilis, which are well-reasoned theological opinions. Sententia pia, options which seem to be in agreement with the consciousness of the faith. And opiniones tolerate, an opinion which is weakly founded, but tolerated by the church. Okay, so you may be sitting there this morning thinking, okay, my head hurts, right? Okay, so what does all this mean, and why is it actually important for my life as a Catholic? As Ludwig Ott succinctly describes it, with regard to the teaching of the church, it must be noted that the assertions of the teaching authority of the church on questions of faith and morals are infallible and consequently irrevocable. Those that are infallible come from when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, solemnly defining a teaching already present in divine revelation as binding on the faithful, and ecumenical councils representing bishops of the entire world. You know what? There's only ever been 21 of them. And even in councils, only those things that are definitively teaching on faith and morals, not disciplinary decisions. The ordinary, usual teaching authority of the Pope, the decisions of the dicasteries of the Roman Curia, which is the papal bureaucracy, none of that is infallible. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all. It means that there should be more than just respectful silence. There needs to be what theology calls a religious obsequium. But even that inner obligation may cease when a competent expert, after a renewed scientific investigation of all grounds, arrives at the positive conviction that the decision rests on an error. The church also traditionally assigns censures to those who hold opinions to the contrary. But you know what? They're not all the same either. A heretical proposition, proposition proximate to heresy, proposition savoring of heresy, an erroneous proposition, a false proposition, a temerarious proposition, a proposition offensive to pious ears, a captious proposition, a scandalous proposition. Even the church's censures presuppose that there are some things, like heretical propositions, which land you outside the visible full communion of the church, all the way down to scandalous propositions that the hierarchy of the church would encourage you to avoid, but that don't break communion with the church. The level of obedience which we owe to various church teachings is directly proportional to how much assent is required of a certain teaching because of the level of its importance. That means that there is actually a great room for freedom and discussion. Even the highest levels of church teaching are not approached in a fundamentalist way. And that's something that I fear we are beginning to forget. Why? Well, the Wild West of social media now has people with no training in theology or canon law, proof texting the Bible, the catechism, the code of canon law, and liturgical rubrics all over the place to support arguments and label and mislabel people they disagree with as bad Catholics. There is this flattening by which bishops, priests, and laypeople want to pretend that whatever they are passionate about is just as important as the Trinity and the resurrection, and that they have the right to censure other Catholics who don't agree with them. My friends, at its root, this is profoundly un-Catholic. Also, Catholics who want to be obedient, faithful members of the church sometimes struggle with one church policy or decision or statement or another, that they stop going to church at all, leave the Catholic Church, or stay but angry and bitter. Catholics come to the confessional because they feel that somehow they're guilty of the mortal sin of disobedience because they're upset about something in a papal interview, a bishop's tweet, or a parish secretary's bulletin editing. Okay? All of this could be so much more simple. While these distinctions of teaching, assent, and obedience that we've just gone through may seem to be awfully complicated. And again, don't worry, after the end of this sermon series, there will not be a quiz, okay? But they actually make it easier for Catholics to see where they truly need to align themselves with the teaching of Christ and where they actually do have a greater freedom in belief and action than they may realize. When we engage in authentic dialogue of hearts and minds, remember the words of St. Paul, at the end, the only thing that will remain is love. So when we engage in authentic dialogue of hearts and minds motivated by charity and justice, obedience and freedom take their proper place in the Christian life. As soon as we grow deaf to our Christian brothers and sisters and stop working towards what is loving and what is right, freedom becomes imperiled or unhinged, and obedience becomes either a sham or a straitjacket. But it doesn't have to be this way.